Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Okay, so let us start tonight's questions. So, the first one is a leftover from yesterday, and this was the question about the Anguttara Twos. There's a sutta that mentions monks, there are these two powers, the Pachavekana, which means something like reviewing, or is it Pachavekana or is it Patisanka, I'm not sure. It's either reviewing or, I think, reflection power, and the reflection and the power of bhavana, the power of development. There are these two powers. Yes, that was a very nice sutta, and I agree it fitted very well in with the theme that we're talking about yesterday, because the Pachavekana bala, or the Patisanka, I'm not sure which one it was now, bala, is basically a kind of wisdom practice. And the way it is defined in that sutta, it says that this particular power is the power when you reflect that bad actions, bad speech, bad thoughts now, they lead to suffering in this life, and they lead to suffering in the future. And then based on that, you actually abandon the bad conduct of body, speech and mind. So it's like an understanding of what's going on. You know, we may all think that, oh, it's bad to do these things, it will lead to suffering, but it has to go quite deep for you to be able to abandon it and give it up. You have to understand it quite deeply. So this is the power of reflection. When it really works, you can, you know, dispel these things. And the Buddha says you understand this, and then you actually abandon this based on that. And then the power of bhavana is defined in the Sen Sutta as the practice of the four jhanas. That's the power of bhavana, the development of the jhanas. So you use the wisdom, you use the understanding of the Dhamma to abandon the defilements, and then based on that abandoning of defilements, you then develop the samadhi of the jhanas. So that's a very good point, very precisely what we're talking about yesterday here. Okay, so now let us start with today's questions. Here is one falling like an airplane, I think. Very interesting, yeah. Okay. Okay. What is the difference between Ajahn Brahmali and Ajahn Brahm? And what is the difference between Ajahn Brahm and Ajahn Shah? Okay. I think the difference is quite... enormous, to be quite honest with you. I think there's some very serious differences here. I think the difference between Ajahn Brahm and Ajahn Shah, maybe I don't really count in this kind of context. You know, we're talking about Ajahn Brahm and Ajahn Shah, you're talking about people who are very, both of them very, very powerful meditators. Now, if you ask Ajahn Brahm about Ajahn Shah, Ajahn Brahm would say that he thinks Ajahn Shah probably was an arahant. So, I mean, it's impossible to know these things. You can't really know. But, you know, he was obviously a very powerful person, and many people had a lot of faith in him, people who were able to, you know, judge in a competent way. So I think he may have been an Arahant. And even if it wasn't an Arahant, it doesn't matter. He obviously was somebody very, very developed in both insight and meditation practice. He was a very, very sharp and very clever, you know, very... when it came to Dhamma, he was very sharp and very to the point. And Ajahn Brahm, you know, I have lived with Ajahn Brahm for 18 years, and I must admit I have a lot of faith. Even after 18 years, you think you'd be disillusioned by something, right? But even after 18 years, I still have faith in Ajahn Brahm. So it is one of those things. So I have a lot of faith in him, exactly where he is, you know, on the path, whether he's fully enlightened or what it is. It's, you know, it's hard. I mean, I have my own ideas. I don't think it's very useful to say anything about these things. It's really up to each one here to judge for themselves what you think about these issues. Because if I say so, and you take what I, you know, on trust what I say, it's not going to be very useful for you. You judge for yourself. You look, and you use some of the ideas I talked about yesterday. Do you see any defilements? Do you see the good qualities there. And if you see these things, then you know it is the right place to have confidence. Whether he is an arahant, whether he is an anagami, a sotapanna, whatever it is, it doesn't really matter, right? If it is a good person practicing and teaching the right way, that is what is important. You will never know these other things anyway. It's impossible. It's very, very hard to know. If people go around telling you that, you know, I'm an arahant and I'm an anagami, whatever, that's when you usually have to be very careful. Usually somebody who is an Aryapugala, somebody who has understood the Dhamma, they will not say anything like that about themselves, because they have very little conceit, right? They don't have much sense of identity. If somebody goes around saying that I am such and I am that, it's usually a bad sign. So that's first kind of, you know, ooh, warning sign when these things happen. That's all I want to say, I think, about that one. Okay. Dear Bhante, regarding your comments on the possibility of an act of killing or stealing being neutral or even good karma, is that not a direct contradiction of the 10 ways of kusala karma and the 10 ways of akusala karma? Okay, so the point I was trying to make is that to understand karma in the right way, karma is not just a rule, right? You must not kill or you must not steal. Karma is based on, if you read the suttas, and you read the suttas carefully, karma is based on intention. It is your intention or your motivation or the driving force, the thing that drives you to do something. That is what determines the ethics of an action, right? So all I'm saying is that if it is possible to do something like stealing, but coming from compassion, if that is possible, then it may not be a bad act, right? Because it is the intention again that matters. Where are you coming from? What is driving the act? Is it possible to kill somebody and be neutral karma or good karma? I think it's very hard to say. But what I'm saying is that if you look at the intention, and the intention can vary enormously, it's important to take that into account. An act of killing is not just killing. It depends on how you do it. It depends on why you do it. That is really the main point. If you kill somebody out of anger simply because you're upset with somebody, it's terribly bad karma, right? But if you, but there can be all kinds of circumstances. Let's say you kill somebody in self-defense, more or less by accident. Is that the same as killing somebody out of anger, out of greed? And of course the answer is no, it's not the same thing. It's a very different motivation, a very different intention. So this is what matters in karma, is to understand that motivation and intention is really the main factor here. And that's really was what I was getting at. And I was then taking some extreme examples to suggest that in certain cases maybe it is not bad karma. Okay, whenever the passage of the gradual training appears in the Sutta Pitaka, the Buddha never says he abstains from all kind of intoxicants, alcohol and drugs, etc. Why is such an important thing omitted, when in fact under the influence of various intoxicants one is very likely to commit seriously unwholesome acts? Just for example, a monk does of course not drive a car, but extremely many car crashes happen due to drunk driving. And drunken person is likely to do the wrong speeds, etc. Yes, it is a very good point. It is certainly part of the monastic vinaya. And you know, if you are a monk or a nun, you're not supposed to drink, right? There is a rule against that, so you certainly can't drink as a monastic. And why it is missing from the gradual training, it may simply be that the act of drinking itself, just on its own, may not be terribly bad karma on its own right. And that's why when you read the fifth precept, it always says you should not use drugs and alcohols that are the basis for heedlessness, right? Pamadatana means the basis for heedlessness. So it is the actual the heedlessness, which is a consequence of the drinking, that is the real problem. And that is why you're making bad karma. So I think, and this I think might be the reason, because the gradual training talks about the actual bad things. It doesn't actually specifically say you shouldn't drink, but it's sort of implied, because if you do drink, you are very likely to do, as you say here, to do bad things. But I think there are other things about drinking, even though it may not be so much bad karma in its own right, there are other problems with alcohol. And one of the problems with alcohol is that you get used to it, you get used to liking it, right? And once you start to like something, once you start to enjoy something, then you are setting a habit pattern for yourself, and that habit pattern is likely to follow along for many, many lifetimes also in the future. And that is what is a bit scary, and that is a bit concerning, because if you create a habit that you take with you into the next life, and maybe in the next life, maybe the Dhamma isn't there, maybe you go in the wrong circumstances, and then you take that drinking habit with you, you don't know where it's going to end. It could end, you know, you can end up becoming, who knows what, an alcoholic perhaps even, if you have that habit, becomes very strong. And one of the things that the Buddha says in one of the suttas is that there are certain things in life for which there is no satiation, there is no satisfaction, there is no point when you've had enough. And one of those things, the Buddha says, is precisely drinking. So once you start to enjoy it, there is a tendency to always increase, always go a bit further. And of course, if you then, the habit sort of keeps going from life to life, always doing more, then eventually there comes a point when you're going to be in serious, very serious trouble. And of course, we all know that if you become an alcoholic, you have all kinds of problems with delusion and all kinds of things happening. And it can be very, very damaging. So for these reasons, I think that even if it isn't bad karma in its own right, the long-term consequences can be very serious. It's good to get away from these habits, right? They're basically very, very dangerous. Okay, so let's have a look at the next one here. It is said that samadhi cannot reach yata bhuta jnana dasana. Just vipassana can reach yata bhuta jnana dasana. What do you think about this? Well, that certainly contradicts the suttas almost absolutely. The Buddha, if you read the suttas, there are so many passages. I mean, it's literally all over the place in the suttas. You read the suttas that have to do with vipassana practice, and if you go, the vipassana practice is mostly found in the Sanyutta Nikaya. Sanyutta Nikaya has all the suttas on the five aggregates, right? The Panchakanda. It has the suttas on the Salayatana, the six sense bases. And these are basically suttas about insight practice, because we're trying to understand the khandhas, we're trying to understand the sense bases. But even there, when you read there, it always says that it gives you the sequence from piti comes pasadi, from pasadi comes sukha, from sukha comes samadhi, from samadhi comes yathabhutananavasana, from samadhi it comes. Right? That's what it says. The cause of yathabhutananavasana is not vipassana, it's samadhi that gives rise to these things. That is so, it's a very interesting, it's a very important thing here. So that is actually what gives rise to this. So what about vipassana then? Vipassana is, vipassana can be, you know, divided into many categories, but there is like the vipassana you have before samadhi. And vipassana before samadhi is the things that help you to move towards samadhi. Vipassana just basically means seeing things in the right way. It means like clear seeing or something like that. So whenever you, think in terms of dukkha, you think in terms of anicca or anatta, it is, you are developing the anicca sanya, the dukkha sanya, the anatta sanya. So you're moving in the right direction. That is a type of vipassana practice. So vipassana goes with you. You can use that at all stages of the path, and that should help you to deepen your samadhi. Why does vipassana help you deepen your samadhi? Because vipassana, when you see things as they actually are, you start to let go. If you see that something is suffering, you let go, right? When you let go, you have less attachment, you have less craving, you become more peaceful. So that's why vipassana leads to samadhi, because you're letting go, you're becoming more peaceful. And samadhi leads to vipassana, because when you become more peaceful, more calm, you have less defilements in the mind, you can see things more clearly. You can see, you know, the defilements are like delusion, they confuse the mind, you cannot see properly. So the more clear the mind is, the more vipassana you can have. So this is what they, you know, many of the teachers you hear about, and also you find this in the suttas as well, they say that samadhi and vipassana, or sambhata vipassana, are just two sides of the same coin. You cannot really separate them. Vipassana leads to sambhata, sambhata leads to vipassana, they always go together. So these are how it goes. And then when you get to real samadhi, you get a real deep state, maybe a jhana state or something like that. Well, that is when your mind is so pure. For the first time, you can really see things as they actually are. Prior to that, it's only approximate, because there are still defilements in the mind. As long as there are defilements in the mind, you cannot see things completely as they are. Only when the defilements are completely gone can you do that. And that's why it's called Yatha Bhuta Jnanadasana. And at that stage in the practice, all you really have to do is to direct the mind into the right area. You don't really have to do a lot of contemplation or sit down. You can sit down if you want, or you can walk. But the most important thing is just that you direct the mind in the right area. And people can have deep insights on the walking path. You don't have to sit down to have a deep insight. Deep insight can happen almost anywhere, as long as the mind has been prepared in samadhi. So you direct the mind to the five khandhas. You direct the mind looking at, you know, is this impermanent or not? You see the impermanence, and that's when insight happens. Okay. I think this must be the same person. The handwriting looks very familiar. That's okay. It is said Ajahn Shah's meditating training something like Zen. What do you think about this? Okay, did Ajahn Shah meditate something like Zen? I'm not sure about that. It's a story. I'm not sure if I can remember this story now. There was a story when some kind of Zen monk visited Ajahn Shah's monastery, and there was what happened again? It was a very interesting little incident, I think there was some kind of Zen teacher who tried to present Ajahn Shah with a koan, and something about a tiger and something like that, and Ajahn Shah said something, which he tried to sort of dismiss the person, and the person thought, Ajahn Shah, oh, very profound what you what he was saying. It was a rather strange story. I don't know. I think I must admit I don't really know much about Zen practice, I really don't know. I think that the thing is that Zen practice, the original Zen, is just jhana practice, right? It's chan. Chan is the Chinese term. Zen is the Japanese term, and so it's basically the root of that practice is basically samatha and samadhi. And in that sense, I think yes, probably there is many similarities, but I think a lot of the Zen practice that is practiced today, this is just what I hear, I don't know if it actually is true. I guess in Zen, like everywhere else, there's a lot of variety, but a lot of it seems like a fairly superficial kind of meditation compared to the really deep things that you read about in the suttas. Again, this is just my impression. I could be wrong, and if I'm wrong, I apologize for saying something here which is not right. Anyway, sorry I can't give a better answer to that one. Okay, in the Anguttara, there is a sutta describing Sukha Dukkha Patipada. In Dukkha Patipada, the passage does mention about the jhanas. What is your opinion about this? Okay, that is true. As it found in the Anguttara 4, Sukha and Dukkha Patipada. Sukha Patipada is basically the practice where you practice the jhanas and then you attain awakening based on that. And the Dukkha Patipada is described slightly differently. I should really have the suttas in front of me when I talk about these things, because otherwise I'm likely to make mistakes. But the Dukkha Patipada, one is where you do various kinds of contemplations. You do contemplations of impermanence, I think, contemplations of the seeing the non-delight in the whole world, seeing the patikula, the patikula of ahara, which is like the disgust in food, basically. Asubha practice. You do all this other kind of practice. It's like what you might call perhaps insight practice. Not really insight, it's more like samatha practice as well, but on a kind of different level. It's a kind of insight practice, perhaps. So you do all these things instead. The other one is dana. One is painful, one is happy. And there was another sutta which talks about the happy and the painful path is slightly different. And there the painful path is the one where you have a lot of defilements. That's why it's painful. And the other one is if you haven't got any defilements, that's why it's a happy path. So those are the two variations there. But if I remember correctly, and unfortunately because I haven't got the sutta in front of me, sometimes I might get it wrong, but if I remember correctly, in both of these suttas, you practice and eventually you the five indriyas arise in the mind, right? Now the five indriyas, of course, include samadhi. And the usual definition for the samadhi indriya in the suttas is precisely the four jhanas. So it's not as if the jhanas are missing. It's just perhaps a different approach or a different way, or perhaps you reach the jhanas at a different stage perhaps in the practice. But it's not as if the jhanas are missing from that particular path. They're still there, just at a different stage, a different emphasis, etc. So this, of course, has to do with your spiritual faculties. I mean, not everybody, actually very, very few people, are able to attain the jhanas, you know, straight away or with ease. So you need to do all these other things to clarify, clear the mind for samadhi to become possible. So sometimes you have to do the dukkha patipada, you have no choice, because that is where, you know, where your mind is at, so to speak. So you have to read these suttas very carefully. When you read a sutta, you have to read everything that's in there. All the little words may often have a specific meaning. Everything often has a meaning. One of the clues to reading the word of the Buddha is a very important clue, and that is to understand that the teachings are almost always gradual. There is a sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya where the Buddha says specifically that any Dhamma teaching which is taught properly is a gradual Dhamma teaching. And that of course means essentially that most of the teachings of the Buddha are going to be gradual teachings. Except perhaps teachings where there is no proper graduation because you're only talking about, you know, something which doesn't fit graduation. But generally, graduation is what you can expect. That is a very useful thing to keep in the back of the mind when you read the suttas, that they are probably gradual, because then you can actually start to structure it, you can start to understand how it works, right? And this is true also for these suttas. These suttas are very short, but they have a very clear, gradual process to them. The dukkha patipada, the contemplation of various things, then the arising, I think, of the seka bala, perhaps, the powers of the trainee, and then the five indriyas, something like that, and then some kind of penetration of insight later on. Okay. One of the great pieces of advice also when reading the suttas that that Ajahn Brahm told me, Ajahn Brahm said that when many years ago he came to Sri Lanka, and he visited Venerable Ñāṇaponika. Venerable Ñāṇaponika, the famous German monk who did a lot of translation and things. Venerable Ñāṇaponika told Ajahn Brahm that when you read the suttas, you should always take the large mass of teachings, the teachings that are clear, the teachings that occur everywhere in the suttas, and you should read the ambiguous or unclear passages in terms of the large amount of material which actually is clear. That is the right way of doing it. But unfortunately, there's a tendency to take out the obscure passages, right? Because they are kind of more interesting, because nobody knows what they mean, and you can argue more about those passages, have more interesting conversations. And fair enough, that's true. Sometimes you can have interesting conversations, but don't make too much out of them. Don't kind of base your understanding of the Dhamma on an obscure passage. If you do that, you're very likely to get into trouble. Okay, let's move on to the next one. Dear Bhante, okay, I think I know what's coming here. Or do I? Let's have a look. According to the third Parajika, if we help a person to die or praise that your life is hopeless, why not commit suicide rather than living, we will commit parajika. Yes, that is quite correct. So please don't do that. If you do that, you might be in trouble. So that's a very good pointer. So as a monk, you have to be very careful. You should not actually tell a lay person that, you know, in this case, it's good for this person to die, you know, or help them in any way whatsoever. So when I say, what I said, that maybe there are situations, I'm not saying that there is any specific situations like that. In any specific situation, you know, people have to make up their own mind. In any case, I don't know. I can't tell whether somebody's mind is pure or not pure. I can't tell them whether actually it is right in this particular case. I'm just saying, as a general principle or Dhamma, it may be, I don't know, in certain situations that actually this may not be so bad. That's all I'm really saying. So, of course, if you, in a specific instance, say that in this case it is good to die, that is where you have a problem. And if you do that and the person then acts on that, yes, you may commit a parajika. So you have to be very careful about these things. You can teach the Dhamma, but you cannot give specific advice in these situations. I think it is very dangerous to help a very sick person to die. Best option is to preach the Dhamma. Sure, yeah. Especially anatta-sanya, no self. Generally speaking, I agree. It is, of course, very useful to teach the Dhamma. But it depends. Some people may not be willing or wanting to listen to the Dhamma, right? What do you do then? Maybe they have no interest in Dhamma whatsoever. You just don't know. You know, the thing is that in one of the reasons I brought this up is because it has been this idea of euthanasia and assisted suicide, wanting to die, has been a very big topic in the Western world, certainly in Australia and many other Western countries. So the question then is, well, what is the Buddhist position on this? Because we often get asked about the Buddhist position. And once you start thinking about these things, actually, it is not as simple as you might think. You know, initially you think, of course, you know, people shouldn't die. But actually, is that true? What, you know, sometimes there are very extreme positions where people are suffering, they don't feel there's any hope. Is dying in those circumstances, if they really want to die, is it necessarily wrong? And I think the answer is not very clear, is not very obvious, depends on so many factors. And it's very hard to generalize and say, yes, it is always wrong or always right. So this is really the point here. Yes, ideally, I agree, it's good to teach the Dhamma. If the person is open to the Dhamma and they're open to practice and they want to use their last weeks or months to, you know, to let go or to deepen their understanding, it's wonderful. And of course, you know, that should be supported if at all possible. But one of the things about, you know, the first precept as well is that when you read the first precept, it says, when you talk about depriving somebody of life, it's jivita voropeya, voropeti. And that quite literally means to deprive somebody of life. And it is that, the jivita voropeti, depriving of life, that is what is the bad thing here. But if somebody wants to die, are you depriving them of life? It's like, I want to give you this. If you take it from them, you're not depriving them of anything because they want to give it up anyway. So these are the kind of issues that are involved. Okay. Also, what do you make of the absence of any mention of intoxicants? In the section of virtue that you have just read. I will comment on that, so let's we'll leave that one aside. Wow, okay, there's a whole essay. Okay. Okay, so let's have and see what this says. My younger days, my father and mother were separated, and most of the time I was alone. And I had a miserable childhood. Okay, I'm sorry to hear that. Now I'm married, but no children. A few years I had a house. A few years I had a house. Problem. I stayed my wife's brother's house in Australia. He wanted this house back. Meanwhile, my wife started to live with her sister's house. And I started to build a small house about 10 kilometers behind that area, okay? My problem is, when I am alone, my past problems creating disturbances in my mind. As I'm looking at 10 acres of tea land, this area, once a week, to going to see my wife. Okay? If there is any answer through Dhamma, is there any answer through Dhamma or through meditation, please let me know. It will be very helpful to me, as my wife is very lazy and shy. She has no answer to my problem. Okay. The thing is that, you know, if to basically with things that happened in the past, thing that we have to do is we have to learn to let go of the past. How do you let go of the past? To be able to let go of the past, you have to forgive the past things. Only when you forgive something can you actually let go. How do you forgive? Well, one way of forgiving is to try to understand the other person. When you understand somebody, you can also usually forgive. There's a nice saying in French. I'm not very good, my French isn't very good, but the French saying is something like, if you understand everything, you can forgive everything. To understand all is to forgive all. And why is that? Because the reason is because people act for reasons, right? There's a reason why people act in a certain way. And once you understand the reasons why they act in that way, you say, oh yeah, now I understand. Now I understand why you did these things. And then you can forgive. And very often, with some of the interviews I had today, this is kind of a recurring problem. How do you let go of the past? How do you let go of things that happened before? And again, one of the best ways that I often like is to remind myself that whatever anybody has done in the past, including myself actually, you just remember that the reason why they did these things is not often because they want to be bad or they want to be, you know, hurt us or anything like that. The reason why people do these things is because they are conditioned in a certain way. People have a certain conditioning, and then they can't help themselves. They do bad things, even if they want to do good things. They can't stop themselves from doing bad things because of their conditioning. Remember, the Buddha's teaching is a teaching about no self, right? There's nobody in here who controls you. What you are a product of the conditions that have conditioned you. And because you are a product of your conditions, there's nothing inside of you that can say, stop, I'm going the wrong way. When things are going the wrong way, you don't know what's happening. And you just do the wrong thing regardless. And when you know that somebody does something bad, even though they actually want to be good, of course people want to be good. We all know in our heart that goodness leads to happiness. And most people know that anyway. So if they do something bad, despite that, it is the conditioning. And the first person they hurt is not us, it's not you, it's themselves is the first person they hurt. They will reap the consequences of their badness many, many times over what we will experience from that pain. And then if you think like that, if you think that they are the first recipient of their problems, they are the first victim of their bad conduct, they are victim of their conditioning, they're not really in charge. Then you can start to understand why they're acting in the way they're doing. Actually, they don't really want to do that. They are just a result of conditionings, of the conditioning of the past. And of course, the other thing we have to be very careful with. One of the problems with relationships is that we often take things personally, right? When somebody says something bad to you, you feel that it's personal. It's between me and that other person. But is it really personal? And it isn't really personal, because if somebody says something bad to you, they say that bad thing because at that point all the conditions are ripe for that person to say something bad. And you happen to be present, so that's why you bear the brunt of all those conditions coming together. If another person, maybe similar to you, had been in that place, they would have been, you know, bore the brunt of that bad speech or whatever. So it's not actually personal. It's just the conditions in that person coming together. It's non-self again. So again, when you understand that other people's bad conduct towards you is not personal, it takes away so much of the pain in the problem. It is never, bad conduct is never personal. It's just that person being themselves, doing what they're conditioning forces them to do in that particular situation. So these are some of the ways of taking, you know, being able to understand what is going on. And then when you understand, you can forgive. You can even have compassion for the other person because you see their problem. And that, then when you forgive, then that forgiveness actually is the same thing as letting go. Forgiving really is letting go. And then the problem is solved. So please try some of these things. Don't try to avoid carrying the past around with you. Everybody has had painful experience in the past. This is part of what it means to be born into this world. So the only way is to actually forgive all that. Try to understand, let it go. Okay, Bhante, when someone is looking at his sitting posture, moving from head to toes 3-4 times and then paid attention to the breath very quickly, he was unaware of anything, no breath, no body, no feeling, no other hearing or anything. But he wasn't asleep, okay? Until he became normal, he was still without any movement. Okay, after a while, when he got to normal, he feels very relaxed and pleasant. Was that a jhana state too? If so, what should one do next? Okay, it's unlikely to be a jhana state because jhana states, as I was saying yesterday, are incredibly profound. I think one of the problems often with the jhana states is that people don't appreciate how profound these states actually are. Uttari manusadama, superhuman states. Sambodhuka, the happiness of awakening. These are extremely profound states. So you shouldn't really be too disappointed if you can't attain a jhana, because if you did, you are almost there at awakening already. That's how profound these things are. But of course, these are the kind of indicators which kind of move you in that direction. You're obviously going in the right way here. But a lot of things happen before you get to jhana. There's a lot of bliss in meditation before jhana. There's a lot of peace in meditation before jhana. The senses start to shut down before you get to jhana, right? You can be in a fairly deep samadhi and feel like all the senses are shut off. And then there's a loud sound, and it's like some sound in the distance somewhere. You can hear it far away. And that can penetrate through that state. So you're not still in jhana. So it is unlikely, that is, I cannot say absolutely, it's a little bit vague perhaps, the description here, a little bit hard to make a say absolutely one way or the other. But a jhana state usually is, you become more and more peaceful, more and more blissful, more and more happy. And then there is a point when you drop into jhana. There is like a particular trigger point where it actually happens. So usually you have to be aware of like a change in awareness of a particular trigger. And that is usually the entry into jhana. Jhana upasampajja, having entered upon viharati, he dwells in the jhana. So that is usually one way of knowing that. And that is when you are basically stuck in the jhana, as I say here. I'm following largely Ajahn Brahm's teaching here. This is how he normally teaches these things. But don't be concerned. Don't feel bad if you haven't attained jhana. Just enjoy the path. There's so much happiness. There's so much nice meditation to be had before you get there. And isn't it wonderful if jhana is even more profound? Isn't that great? We're moving towards these amazing things. You know, the jhanas, awakening, all these things. The more profound it is, the more exciting it is, the more interesting it is. Not exciting in a kind of bad way, but in a very profound and deep way. Okay. Ajahn, can you please explain the step sequence from the beautiful breath through the awareness of losing the body and breath and the appearance of the nimitta? Can there be a notion of heat before the appearance of nimitta? Thank you. how do we... Okay, last one is, how do we make appointment to meet me? Is that through you, Bhante?
Yeah, that's been done.
It's been done. Okay, good, yeah. Okay, so... well, basically, if you get to the beautiful breath, you're not usually that far away from the nimittas either. These are fairly close, depending on how beautiful the breath is and all these kind of things, of course. But the beautiful breath, basically, and again, the way Ajahn Brahm teaches these things, he would say that the beautiful breath is just the breath together with happiness, right? And many people have experienced that. You are watching the breath, and there's a sense of piti sukha there while you're watching the breath. So this is the beautiful breath. Beautiful because it's nice, because it's pleasant. And once you have the piti sukha, then all what you have to do is just to continue developing the piti sukha. Things start to calm down. And when things start to calm down, there comes a point in that process when it becomes so peaceful that a light can appear in the mind. And this is what often is called the nimitta, right? The samadhi nimitta. And it's at that, you know, so anywhere in that process, the body is already fading into the background. Even when you're watching the breath, the body can often be very, very weak, right? It's almost like it's in the background already. And the deeper you go in the meditation, the more further away the body tends to be. And when we get to the nimitta stage, the body has almost disappeared. It's not impossible to feel the body, perhaps, but it's very unlikely that you will feel the body at that stage. Can there be a notion of heat before the appearance of the nimitta? This is one of the things about, you know, experiences in meditation, that so many things can happen during meditation experience. And if you hear about meditators, if you are like me, you know, or like Ajahn, you know, anybody who listens to people talk about the meditation experiences, wow, it's amazing the diversity of experiences and strange visual things, strange feelings in the body, even sometimes hearing things that people have in meditation. Because this is often what happens when you start to calm down. All these things often come into your mind, the conditioning from the past come into your mind, and these can be affected through feelings in the body, visual experiences, auditory experiences. All these kind of things can actually happen. So yes, it can happen. It usually doesn't mean anything. Usually it's just one more kind of perception that you have as you are going through the process, moving towards samadhi. So don't worry about these things. You know, these experiences are secondary. They don't really matter. What you want to do is just keep your focus, to keep moving deeper in the experience. So I hope you are happy with that. I'm not going to say anymore anyway, so. Okay. Bhante, it says, from time to time we should practice samadhi, upeka, and the pagaha nimittas. Can you explain the meaning of the word pagaha and how actually we should practice it, please? Okay, well, this particular sutta that you are referring to is in the Anguttara Nikaya. It's the sutta after the one I was teaching the other day. And yes, that is indeed what it says, but this sutta is actually very profound, and that is one reason why I didn't want to get into it, because I think it talks about somebody who is already has very deep samadhi and how they should practice the samadhi in the right way. Because that sutta says that if you focus too much on the samadhi, you can get like lazy, because, you know, samadhi is so pleasant, it's such a nice state, that all you want to do is to be in the samadhi state, and you don't exert yourself enough. Pagaha is exertion, right? It's putting forth effort, if you like. But because it is so nice, it means that you don't actually put forth enough effort in the practice. So that's what it means. So if you find that your samadhi becomes so deep that all you want to do is just sit there all day, that is when you should be concerned about this. But usually, it's very few meditate that this, you know, this problem arises for, because it is a very profound thing here. And yes, it also talks about upeka. So what this sutta says, it basically says that there is the right time for samadhi, practice the deep meditation. There's the right time for upeka. Upeka, the meaning of upeka is to look on, right? That's the main meaning. It's from the verb pekati. Pekati means to look. And upeka means looking on. So it means like you just stand back and you look without kind of reaction to things, right? You're just observing things. That's what upeka means. So there's a right time for just observing without reaction. There's a time right time for samadhi, and then there is the right time for exertion. That is pangaha. So you have to balance these things so you don't actually, you don't kind of fall into the trap of stopping halfway here. Okay, so in some countries like Sri Lanka, Burma, there is a very strong emphasis on Abhidhamma. Dhamma teachers often quote from Abhidhamma when asked questions on the practice. They at times contradict the explanations given in the suttas. Okay? Could you briefly explain the history, the role of the Abhidhamma in the actual practice? Thank you. Okay? I agree that the Abhidhamma, one of the problems with the Abhidhamma is that it has been elevated to something very special. And often if you ask people, what is kind of the ultimate answer, what is the ultimate teaching of the Buddha, they will say the Abhidhamma is the ultimate teachings. The suttas are like the preliminary, and the Abhidhamma, that's the real stuff, the really kind of full teachings. And that is very unfortunate that people should say that, because it is, from a historical point of view, if you look at when the suttas were given, it's very clear to me, and very clear to many, that they were given by the Buddha, because they fit historically into that framework. Whereas the Abhidhamma, all scholars, who really study these things, scholars of language, scholars of doctrinal evolution and these kind of things, it's very obvious that the Abhidhamma comes from a later phase of Buddhism than the suttas. So the Abhidhamma, although they are based on the suttas, although there are quotations from the suttas in the Abhidhamma, like the Abhidhamma Vibhanga, for example, there are lots of quotations from the suttas, part of the Abhidhamma is from a later phase of thinking. And that makes it problematic. And what is even more problematic is that when people talk about the Abhidhamma, often they don't actually mean the Abhidhamma Pitaka. What they mean are the commentaries that comment on the Abhidhamma Pitaka. Because the Abhidhamma itself is often just long lists of synonyms and words, and it's very hard to make much sense of unless you add the commentaries as well. And the commentaries are, of course, even later than the Abhidhamma, right? Because you have to write the commentary after the main work has been written. That is just common sense, really. So that is unfortunate. It's unfortunate that we should emphasize something that was not spoken by the Buddha as being better than what was spoken by the Buddha. That's essentially what we're doing when we're emphasizing the Abhidhamma. So I say, we don't really have to make any decision whether the Abhidhamma is wrong or right, or whether it is right in some parts and wrong in some parts. Personally, I feel that if I look at the Abhidhamma, I feel that there are areas where it does not agree with the suttas. That's my personal feeling here. But we don't really have to worry so much about that. What we should worry about is to simply say that we should emphasize the word of the Buddha. The Buddha must have been awakened, right? If the Buddha wasn't awakened, there is no Buddhism. Everything falls apart. So that's why the word of the Buddha is the most important thing here. Other teachers, maybe they were wise, maybe they were not. We just don't know who they were. We don't know where these teachings come from. They arose throughout history. And it is likely that if somebody produces very kind of difficult intellectual systems, it is often likely to be product of people who like to think rather than practice. That's usually the way these things go. So because of that, I think we don't really have to decide so much on whether the Abhidhamma is right or wrong, but we can say, we'll put it to one side. There's no need to actually invest too much time in actually studying the Abhidhamma or worrying too much about it. The strange thing is that the more developed Buddhism becomes, the more Abhidhamma you have, the more commentaries you have, the more Visuddhimagga you have, all these kind of things. More of that, the less practice usually, right? That usually goes hand in hand. The more scholarly things, the less practice. That is the strange thing about these things. That is an important thing to keep in mind. I think that is maybe the maybe hopefully that answers the question fairly well, and Okay. If you want to get back on that one, you want to ask in more details, please do so later on. Okay. Next one. I do breathing meditation, Anapanasati. Sometimes the breath becomes very soft, and nimitta is also there. Sometimes I feel that I go deep into the nimitta and then didn't feel anything for a while. After I become back to normal state, it is very pleasant and relaxing. Venerable Sir, what should I do next? Okay. Before getting up from the meditation, can I do some vipassana from there? And how to do so? All right. So what you basically, if you do get things like nimittas arising in your mind, that is a wonderful thing, and you should be very happy that these things happen, because that means that your mind is already very pure. So what do you want to do from there? You just want to continue with that nimitta, continue focusing on the nimitta, and try to go even deeper in the meditation practice. So all you have to do at this point is just to be passive, right? It is what we're trying to do is to reduce the activity in the mind as much as possible. It's the activity in the mind that keeps the mind moving a little bit. So the more passive you can be, the more you can just like stand back or sit back and watch that nimitta and be completely still, then there is a chance that that nimitta will become brighter and eventually you might even attain a jhana state or something like that. So that is, already doing very, very well. So be very pleased that you're doing so well. Don't expect anything, don't expect any results. Just enjoy and be content in that state where you are. And then you will be moving in the right direction. So already it's very good. Should I do some vipassana practice from there? And how to do so? You can do vipassana from there. How exactly you would do vipassana in that state? Well, normally the point about the jhanas is that they are already a state of yathabhuta nanadasana. So all you really have to do is just to reflect sometimes. Reflect on any aspect of the five khandhas. Are they permanent? Are they impermanent? Can you see why they are impermanent? You know, the standard explanation in the suttas for how to do vipassana practice after jhana is all you have to do is to reflect on the five khandhas, and you reflect on the five khandhas, actually reflect on the jhana itself in terms of dukkha, anatta, and anicca. And when you're able to see the jhanas as dukkha, anatta, anicca, that's when you can make the breakthrough to very profound states of awakening. So how do you do that? Well, you remember that they have been produced, right, through a certain practice. Anything which has been produced through a certain practice is by definition impermanent, because once those qualities that produce it disappear, the state itself will also disappear. So this is the kind of reflection you can do, and it's basically, this is how vipassana practice mostly seems to be done in the suttas. You reflect on that state you have had, and you consider it in terms of the three characteristics. If you look at the Anapanasati Sutta, it takes you through the whole sequence of Anapanasati all the way up to the Vimochayang Chittang, or something like that. The freeing of the mind, which essentially means samadhi or jhana state. And then you do the Anicca Nupasana, the Anicca Viraga, Niroda, and Patanisaga contemplations after that. So what do they refer to? They refer to the whole process you have been through, right? So you understand the process. You see how things have disappeared in that process. You see the body disappearing. You see the senses disappearing. And eventually, perhaps, you see also the will disappearing. So that is what you focus on. You reflect on those things. You reflect on the process that you have been through. And you see the three characteristics as relating to that process. The most important thing to focus on is anicca, impermanence, or niroda, things disappearing, because that is often the foundation stone for also understanding dukkha and anatta. So just reflect on your own experience and look back and see how things have disappeared, and that is often how you can understand these particular things. Okay, whenever I sit for meditation, very quickly breath becomes soft and I feel like floating up into the sky. Sometimes feel like climbing a staircase, sometimes feel like going up in a lift? Should I just keep waiting? What's happening next? Or anything else should I do next? It doesn't matter whether you float or whatever. If you really do float, I would like to see it. It would be very interesting to see that. But it's usually just a perception in your mind. You feel like you're floating, but actually you're not really floating. It's just another one of those things that happen in meditation. A feeling in the body, a feeling in the mind, a visual experience, whatever it is. So don't worry about that. Just keep on floating. Just keep on enjoying the meditation. That's all that matters. Go back to the breath. Go back to the nimitta, whatever it is that you're doing here. Okay, I think this might be the last one. We can leave a few for tomorrow, perhaps. Bhante, can you please tell us the name and the number of the sutta in which the Buddha details how one should investigate him to verify his claim to be fully awakened? The name is the Vimamsaka Sutta, and it's Majjhima Nikaya 47. If someone claims to be enlightened, but they don't possess the qualities of the gradual training, can that person's claim be dismissed? So, for instance, if they don't have perfect confidence in the triple gem, or if they don't have good sila, or are not content with little, can such a person possibly be an arahant? I would say no. I think that's probably the answer. We have to understand, of course, what good sila means. It doesn't mean that you are always going to be absolutely perfect. Even arahants can make little mistakes in what is called conventional precepts, the precepts or convention. They can make mistakes as well. If they don't have perfect confidence in the triple gem, that is very hard to understand how you can even be a stream entry, a sovan, if you haven't got perfect confidence in a triple gem. So anybody who says something about the Dhamma or the Buddha, which kind of sounds like it's a bit dismissive, would not be a stream entry or an Arya. So, and yes, I think it's very true, they would be content with little. So if somebody is not content with little, that's also a very, very bad sign. You know, an arahant is somebody who has no desires, he has no worldly goods. One of the qualities of the arahant in the suttas is that he's not able to store things up like people do in household life. And that is one of the reasons why it's impossible to be a householder and an arahant. Because an arahant cannot store things up. It cannot really live the household life anymore. So that's why when you become an anagami, that is kind of the highest stage of a householder, in an arahantship. As soon as you become an arahant, basically you are a monk from that point on, or a nun from that point on. You're no longer a householder. You have lost the kind of the mind of a householder. Okay, maybe let's leave these for tomorrow. There's a few left in there. It's already 9:30, so probably we have gone long enough.